Good evening, everyone. Welcome. This is Dr. Nalini Chilko. Welcome to our live Grand Rounds call for the Foundation of Integrative Oncology course. This call will last approximately 1 hour, but probably more tonight. We have a really full call. I'll start with a clinical pearl. Then I'm going to go over the questions that were submitted, and I really want to spend most of the time on this great advanced prostate cancer case that was submitted for this month. So please be mindful if you ask questions to protect patient privacy and don't mention patient name or identifying information. You're currently muted, but if you want to ask a question or interject, you can press *7 to unmute yourself, and I'll pause as we go through the call, give you opportunity to ask questions periodically as I am speaking. So I'm going to start tonight with a clinical pearl that is about protecting the blood-brain barrier. And we put a link on the website on the Grand Rounds call page for the clinical pearl slides. And we also put a link on the Grand Rounds call page for the case study. So you could actually follow along. And we're going to do that every single month now so that you actually have slides to look at and the case study to look at during my talk. And of course, everything gets posted after the call. For this call also, there's quite a number of reference articles that were uploaded to the library for you if you want to go back and look at any references. So I'm going to charge ahead with some resources for repairing the blood-brain barrier. And this is really important because cancer physiology itself damages the blood-brain barrier because of the increase in inflammatory cytokines and matrix metalloproteinases that are part of cancer physiology itself. And then, of course, there are chemotherapy-induced inflammatory storms. And, of course, radiation is inflammatory and immunotherapies are inflammatory. And all these can breach and damage the blood-brain barrier, which is just like the barrier in the gut. It's one epithelial layer thick, and it's is easily damaged. Now, what's important about this and what it's connected to is both fatigue as well as the declining cognitive function, both of which are primary complaints of cancer patients. So we don't just talk about chemo brain, we talk about cancer-related cognitive impairment and also chemotherapy or treatment-induced cognitive impairment. And this looks like deficits in attention, memory, and executive functions. And we'll see that specific parts of the brain are also impaired. Processing speed is affected, attention is affected, concentration, spatial learning, neurogenesis is inhibited. So the brain not only gets damaged, but its ability to repair itself is also compromised. So you want to, when you have a patient, include this in your assessment at the beginning and also as the patient goes through therapy. They might not report it to you. 45% of patients do complain about it, but most people are experiencing some of it. Certainly people who use more of their executive and cognitive functions and on a daily basis professionally will notice it more, but it's really happening to everyone. And it does cause accelerated brain aging as well. And it can impair relationships, professional performance, and the ability just to function well. You want to also get a sense of what kind of the cognitive reserve of that person is. So if you have a 95-year-old, you can expect that there has been some age-related cognitive decline. But if you have a younger person and they're experiencing cognitive decline, they might not recognize it or realize what's going on with them. So it's also educational, patient teaching related. So there's a couple of aspects I want to talk about tonight that we can actually have a positive impact on. The blood-brain barrier becomes hyperpermeable and loses its tight junctions just the way the intestinal barrier does. And in this case, we have inflammatory cytokines, particularly interleukin-1b. We have the matrix metalloproteinases, primarily MMP9, and then there's also proteolytic enzymes that are present in the tumor microenvironment itself. And at the time of diagnosis, many people are already in a compromised position. Now, the blood-brain barrier is damaged by all of these inflammatory molecules. And there are a couple of things we can do to repair that. Interestingly enough, melatonin can maintain blood-brain barrier integrity. It has anti-inflammatory and antioxidant properties. It's really a neurohormone, but it's also a super neuroantioxidant. And it is very powerful at preserving the blood-brain barrier. I have a couple of studies here, references here for you in the slides, showing it downregulates matrix metalloproteinase 9 and also inhibits NADPH oxidase 2. These are damaging enzymes. And then it will activate SIRT1, which is resveratrol activates SIRT1. And so it helps to repair and protect DNA, which is really important. And the dose that I usually use is between 10 and 20 milligrams. That's where all the research is done. I usually start at 10 milligrams. If someone tolerates that, I see if they can go up to 20. And I will start this in most cancer patients at the beginning of treatment. And remember that I've spoken about melatonin before in the context of breast cancer, and all of my breast cancer patients stay on melatonin long-term as well. So think about using melatonin at bedtime, 10 to 20 milligrams. Several studies show it maintains blood-brain barrier integrity. The other thing that there are some good studies on is astragalus, which is one of the great immunopotentizers in Chinese medicine. We also use astragalus to treat neutropenia and support the bone marrow. So there are studies on astragalus on resolving decreased blood-brain barrier permeability and inhibiting matrix metalloproteinase 9. Remember that it also controls oxidative stress and inflammation. It also is a regulator of apoptosis, and it will also normalize the P53 enzyme. Remember that that is a gene that is the guardian of the genome and determines whether or not an aberrant cell gets an apoptotic self-destruct signal or not. And this is dysregulated in cancer cells. And astragalus also modulates the BCL2 BAX balance, and that's also an apoptotic signaling. So remember that when we use phytochemicals, we have these great multitaskers. We're talking about astragalus in the context of the blood-brain barrier right now, but usually we think of it as an immune modulator, a bone marrow tonic, and a gene regulator. And then it has milder anti-inflammatory and antioxidative properties. So it's one of the great herbs of Chinese medicine for cancer patients. The dose is anywhere from 1 to 6 grams a day. Most of my patients get 3 to 6 grams a day of astragalus. So those two remedies can be used safely in all cancer patients and concurrently with most cancer treatments. There's some caution with astragalus with B-cell leukemias and lymphomas because it does ramp up white cells, so we want to be conservative in those types of cancers. Now, the other aspect of the blood-brain barrier is the increase in neuroinflammation. So we want to be able to decrease the neurotoxicity, decrease neuronal death, and promote neurogenesis, all of which are compromised in the cancer physiology and the cancer treatment physiology. As these cytokines cross the blood-brain barrier, then we also get a ramping up of IL-6 and IL-1B in the brain itself. This is neurotoxic. We get this pro-inflammatory environment in the brain, and then the cancer itself is pro-inflammatory, and it kind of keeps cycling. And part of what gets activated is the microglia. And so then the brain is a inflammatory soup. And so this increases depression as well as fatigue, as well as cognitive decline and impairment. So controlling neuroinflammation is very important. And so we go back to our toolbox, and I've given you a chart of botanicals that cross the blood-brain barrier and anti-inflammatories that can be used for neuroinflammation. And I've given you a chart with all of the cytokines that are influenced by each one of these tools in our toolbox. So the green tea catechins cross the blood-brain barrier. Curcumin crosses the blood-brain barrier. Berberine, resveratrol, and boswellia all cross the blood-brain barrier. So it's really powerful. And then, of course, the omega-3 fatty acids are not only anti-inflammatory, but they rebuild that cell membrane and make it flexible and healthy so that there's good normal receptor binding. So think about that. And then don't forget about using probiotics, because having a normal, healthy microbiome, which, of course, chemotherapy wipes out, will decrease neuroinflammation, normalize neurotransmitter function. And so all of these things are a symphony together. So I might combine green tea, curcumin, omega-3 fatty acids, resveratrol, and boswellia, and that looks like a lot of anti-tumor, anti-inflammatory formulas we already use. All of our patients should be on probiotics. Remember that one of the great herbs of Chinese medicine, Scutellaria bicalensis, huangqin, and we've talked about that a lot. It has a lot of berberine in it, and so quite a lot of our treatment plans will have berberine. And remember, berberine also can act as an insulin sensitizer. So again, we have this toolbox that is filled with multitaskers. I've given you a study on resveratrol, decreasing neuroinflammation. Another study on resveratrol, looking at cognitive impairment, increasing performance, modulating mood, and increasing cerebrovascular function. Nice study on that. And then I also gave you a study on pterostilbene, which is in the family. Resveratrol is a stilbene. Pterostilbene comes from blueberries primarily, and it's a bit more of a potent molecule because it has less bonds in it, and it's just more accessible to our tissue because of that. But it crosses the blood-brain barrier the same way that resveratrol does, and it will inhibit the microglial activation and kind of calm down the inflammation in the brain and lower the amount of neuronal injury. And it also decreases TNF-alpha and IL-6, and it's a little bit more lipophilic than resveratrol, so it's used a bit more in the brain and the central nervous system. So there's a good toolbox for you there. I've given you some studies also on cognitive decline and the gut-brain connection and the impact of the microbiome on cognitive function and cognitive inflammation. And I've also given you a little slide on a new product that I'm using by Claire. It's called Target GBX, and it's a targeted probiotic. Studies on this probiotic were done relative to mood and depression in particular, that this particular blend of probiotics really helps people with depression. But remember that the cause of a lot of depression is brain inflammation, like especially patients that don't respond to antidepressants often respond to anti-inflammatories. So again, this would be a multitasker for us. It'd be a selected, targeted probiotics. So I've started using this in a lot of my patients, and so I encourage you to take a look at that product. It's a broad spectrum, has a group of lactobacillus as well as bifidobacteria of varying species, and it's pretty impressive. And I gave you a couple of references on that gut-brain connection as well. Then curcumin crosses the blood-brain barrier, and I gave you a study on the effects of curcumin on the hippocampus. And the reason that's important is because that's the area of the brain that is the most impacted by cancer physiology and cancer therapies. And the hippocampus is where memory and memory patterning is stored, and it's very important. The other part of the brain that's most affected is prefrontal cortex, which of course has a lot to do with our executive functions as well as our mood. And so these two parts of the brain are most affected. And so I give you a study on curcumin, cognition, and the hippocampus. And there are a lot of studies on the changes both structurally and functionally in the hippocampus in patients with cognitive decline. And there have been a number of studies done looking at the structure of the hippocampus in patients who have cancer and patients who have had chemotherapy, and it has definitely changed. There is a fantastic paper that I put in the slides here called Clearing the Fog, a review of the effects of dietary omega-3 fatty acids and added sugars on chemotherapy-induced cognitive deficits. And so the crux of this paper, it looked at a couple of factors. It looked at what happens in hyperglycemic patients. It looked at what happens in patients who are undergoing active chemotherapy. And so we have a compromised blood-brain barrier. And then these patients have increased neuroinflammation, more mitochondrial dysfunction, more oxidative stress in the brain, and then more microglial activation, which means more brain inflammation. And they tend to be more cognitively impaired and have more neuronal damage. So that's hypoglycemia and chemotherapy. Then they looked at patients who also took omega-3 fatty acids, and in these patients, the hippocampus was protected, and there was actually neurogenesis, and so we have less damage under this milieu of cancer physiology and cancer treatment physiology, and of course, in the OutSmart cancer system, omega-3 fatty acids are one of the core nutrients, and our patients take anywhere from 2 to 6 grams a day. And so, again, you can see how the Materia Medica keeps coming back to some of these core tools that we can use and have a variety of impacts, and really taking a history, understanding if someone's more cognitively impaired, and seeing what we can do about it is, I think, important every time you see a patient to ask them. And then I gave you also a slide on lion's mane mushroom, Hericium erinaceus. In Japan, they call it Yamababushitaki. And that is a really interesting Asian mushroom that has been shown to strengthen memory and concentration and enhance cognition and enhance the stimulation and synthesis of nerve growth factor, and it actually promotes and accelerates myelination. So think about multiple sclerosis and other demyelinating syndromes. And it's also an immune modulator like most of the Asian medicinal mushrooms. And the dose of that would be 3 to 5 grams a day. So in the large, big topic of cancer-related cognitive impairment, and cancer treatment-related cognitive impairment, there is a small toolbox there for you for helping your patients suffer less from those adverse effects. So I'll stop here, and if you would like to comment or ask a question, you can press *7, introduce yourself, and ask the question. Okay. Oh, there's a lot of people here tonight. There's people from all over the West Coast, Miami, Idaho, New York, Northern California, Missouri, Virginia. Fabulous. And Canada. There's people from all over here tonight. All right. So.
Yes. I have a question for you.
Who are you?
This is my name's Bob.
Hi, Bob.
Bob Nesbitt. And I'm have a question. I just started the course. I'm not all the way through it yet, and I'm totally loving it. It's really a lot of information. So thank you for what you put out here. Now, I'm looking at slide 14, and you've got on here 2 to 4 grams a day. Now, I'm going to take it this is in concert with everything combined, not individual items.
Yeah. Yeah, as you go through the course, So hold tight, because we're going to do a case study tonight. You'll see like the doses of the whole symphony of everything together. And also at the end of the course, the later modules have case studies, and you might want to look at those so you kind of get the gestalt of how I put treatment plans together.
Okay. Do we touch on anything as far as dealing with heavy metals with a cancer patient and how you would address that if somebody does have, like, say, lead or aluminum or mercury?
You can submit that as a question, and I'll go over it, but I'm not going to answer it right now because there are a lot tonight. In the course, I don't, just to answer your question directly. I don't have that in the course, but I am developing a series of advanced modules to address a number of topics that are not covered in the course. So I'm always interested, number one, in what you want to hear about in Clinical Pearls and what you'd like to see added to the course. So just keep giving us feedback.
Great. Thank you.
You're welcome. Anybody else? Nope. Okay. So there were a couple of really great questions, and then I'm going to spend the rest of the time on the case because it's a great case. All right. So there was a question from Corey Deacon. Do you have any experience with photodynamic immunotherapy for breast cancer? So the simple answer is no. But let me make some comments. So I don't see photodynamic therapy used very much in the United States. Like, I've never had a patient have it, but it's done in Europe and a lot of integrative cancer therapy clinics. It's interesting because photodynamic therapy was approved as a treatment modality in the United States 30 years ago. It's a little bit odd that it's not used more, but, you know, the drug companies own cancer, and so I think that's part of it because it's a very valuable therapy. Basically, it induces an immune response itself, so it, you could think of it as an immunotherapy, and it's a two-stage process where a photosynthesizer is administered IV, and then light is locally directed over a confined tumor area. The limitation of photodynamic therapy is that the light doesn't penetrate very far, so you can't do deep organ photodynamic therapy at this time, although I did a literature search. There's some experiments being done with fiber optics to get the light inside. And so perhaps we'll see this therapy used more. I gave you a couple of references. One, I gave you a link to the photodynamic therapy information page on the American Cancer Society website. And it's a nice overview of photodynamic therapy. And then there's a couple of really great articles. I gave you a review article from 2017 entitled Oncologic Photodynamic Therapy Basic Principles, Current Clinical Status, Future Directions. And it really explains photodynamic therapy. It's a review of many clinical trials, and its conclusion is it's a valuable therapy and is underutilized. And so it's a very good paper, review paper. There's another review paper from 2018 that I included, which is a review of photodynamic combination therapy and cancer treatment, and it looks at combining photodynamic therapy with radiotherapy, chemotherapy, immunotherapy, and other therapies. And the conclusion of this paper was that by itself, photodynamic therapy is not great, but when it's combined with these other things, just in the same way when hyperthermia is combined, it really amplifies the therapeutic effect. There are some problems with photodynamic therapy. Sometimes there's collateral damage in nearby cells, and it does induce hypoxia, and that's the trigger for angiogenesis. So there's some concern about, you know, what's the right way to do photodynamic therapy. Maybe that's why it's not used as much. And then I did find one study that was done in 2010. It was a murine study on targeted therapy of cancer using photodynamic therapy in combination with other anti-tumor modalities, including immunotherapy. So there's a couple of papers on it, but a lot of the studies are murine studies. There was one study in 2013 called immune-stimulating photoactive hybrid nanoparticles for metastatic breast cancer. So, you know, people are still doing active research on photodynamic therapy, it looks like. You know, here's some 2013, 2014, 2017, 2018 papers. But I just don't see it used a lot in the United States. And so I have no experience with patients who have had it. But I certainly think in Germany they do it. I am aware they do it a lot in some of the integrative clinics there. So that's my answer about that. Did anyone want to comment or ask anything more about photodynamic therapy? Okay. Stacy DeAndre asks about carnitine. Should we be assessing carnitine status? How do you know if a patient is carnitine deficient? Is there a specific lab test? So let me say first that there's a section on carnitine in the course, so you could go back and take a look at that. It's in module 4.2. There is a lab test for carnitine, but it only measures free carnitine in the serum. And remember that carnitine is really stored in the muscle and acts in the mitochondria. So when you measure serum carnitine, you really don't get a sense of how much carnitine is in the body. Now, Quest Labs does have a normal reference range for men and women for serum carnitine. But again, I don't think it's really telling us what we really want to know. So if a patient has sarcopenia, then carnitine is certainly therapeutic. Do we know if they're carnitine deficient? We don't. So even though the test exists, I don't use it. So I don't think it's telling us really what we need to know. And so it's not the right biomarker to answer the question, really. But what you do need to know about carnitine functionally is that it's linked to fragility and geriatric frailty and end-stage disease in HIV and cancer, and it's definitely linked to cancer-related fatigue, cachexia, and sarcopenia. So I think those probably are markers of need for carnitine, but is it something we could reliably measure? It's not widely used, even though it exists. So, for example, I don't know any integrative oncology practitioner that measures it because it doesn't really ask and answer the question. And so, no, I can't. But I think you can assume somebody who has loss of muscle mass due to physiologic process would benefit from carnitine. And so remember, in our therapeutic shake, I always put carnitine in the shake, L-carnitine as carnitine tartrate powder, about 1.5 to 2.0 grams, because cancer patients have a higher need for carnitine. And remember, reference ranges on labs anyway aren't about optimal health. They're, you know, reflections of a mean of a relatively unhealthy population. So not sure they guide us wisely. So I always add carnitine because remember, we're asking patients not to eat a lot of red meat. That's the primary source of carnitine in the diet. So people aren't eating carnitine. And carnitine is an amino acid the body can synthesize. But if the mitochondria are compromised, then it can't do that. And so we know cancer is a disease of mitochondrial compromise. And so I just put it in because of all of those reasons. And there are a lot of food sources of carnitine that aren't red meat. All flesh foods, pretty much fish and poultry included, dairy products. But again, we're limiting these in many patients. And interestingly, whey protein has carnitine in it. So that might be the only way some of our patients are actually getting it in the diet. So I look at the dietary recommendations we make. Our patients are eating low carnitine diets. There's actually a higher need for carnitine in cancer patients. So I just supplement it. But if you do measure it, please be aware that in all diseases of muscle breakdown, serum carnitine can actually go up. So example is sarcopenia, an example is cardiomyopathy, right, and congestive heart failure. So again, that it kind of leads to the conclusion that serum carnitine is not a reliable biomarker, really. I put in a couple of references for you in the notes and reference articles on L-carnitine supplementation reducing fatigue in cancer patients during chemo and some of the mechanisms, another article on mechanisms underlying the anti-wasting effect of L-carnitine under pathologic conditions, and another one on the safety of using carnitine in patients with cancer, fatigue, and deficiencies. So those are all human studies that I put in there. And I'll stop here if there are any carnitine questions. Okay. And then Stacy Giandre, I hope I'm saying your name right, also asked a question about a study, a rat study, which showed that quercetin interacted with the estrogen receptor in ER-positive breast cancer patients, and is that a problem? She also asks, given its interaction with the CYP liver enzymes, do we have to worry about giving it with other chemotherapy? So I'll answer the second question first. Everything interacts with some P450 enzyme. And so this is how I think about it. If we're giving a pharmacologic dose of something in our toolbox, then we might want to look up the drugs that the patient is on and see what is most important. But if you do that, you'll see almost every drug has CYPA4 interactions. And so do a lot of botanicals. And I think about this like eating a salad, you know. I think that there's room for all of it. And the only restrictions I put on is I ask people not to use grapefruit juice because we know it slows down drug metabolism. Therefore, people can get more toxic effects from drugs. That's something I definitely advise patients who are on highly toxic drugs. But I have not found that much of what we do interferes with the P450 metabolism of the agents that our patients are taking in a way that is significant. I'm sure that it's going on, but so many of our foods contain phytochemicals that interact with P450 enzymes. And think about how medicine is practiced today in the polypharmacy, where if you have a elderly patient, they're on, you know, 10 or 12 drugs, and is the physician or the pharmacist worried about the interactions between their P450 enzymes? Unfortunately not. So in my experience, it's not an issue. There are drug interactions that we know, drug-herb interactions that we know about that we should avoid. So, for example, curcumin and the cyclophosphamide family of chemotherapy don't do well together, but there are some botanical drug interactions that actually enhance the therapy. Everything across the board is possible, but the interactions of herbs and nutrients and drugs is, in my experience, I've never had some giant problem. So I think it's important. What we're doing is fairly mild compared to what chemotherapy drugs do. So I take out the botanicals that do have strong detoxification properties and the nutraceuticals during the days of active chemotherapy. So that would be things like the sulforaphanes, milk thistle, and acetylcysteine, things like that that we know definitely impact liver detoxification pathways in a big way. I definitely withhold those because I'm not sure if those interact. So in the interest of safety and to make the oncologist happy, I do that. Remember that IV infusions typically are active for, you know, 3, 4, 5 days. So I'll wait till day 5 or 6 to reintroduce drugs that do have interactions. But I don't withhold all of our herbs and nutrients because I want the patient to be well nourished during the time they're going through a stressful physiology. So that's my approach. Now, quercetin itself has hundreds, if not thousands, of papers on the benefits to cancer patients. and this one paper on rats. So, you know, the truth is that quercetin is a phytoestrogen. Now, phytoestrogens in general, because they loosely bind to the estrogen receptor instead of the tight binding that our own biological hormones have, actually reduce estrogen stimulation. So that's sort of what's so about phytoestrogens in general. They tend not to ramp up estrogen-driven cancers. There are profoundly powerful anti-apoptotic effects of quercetin, and I've given you two really good, pretty current articles on quercetin and one paper on the dietary bioactive natural products in estrogen receptor positive breast cancers. But I want to bring to your attention that there is a Dr. Mohammed Nazami, N-E-Z-A-M-I. I gave you his website, which is allcancercare.com. He's down here in Southern California. He gives ultra high doses of IV quercetin to patients on a daily basis, 5 days a week for several months at a time as a therapy. He has a lot of success with colorectal cancer patients. So we have to remember that phytochemicals are multitaskers. Now, of course, colorectal cancer doesn't always have estrogen receptors, but it can. But in our module 4.3, there is a section on quercetin and tumor inhibition. And in there, we also note that estrogen receptor regulation, down regulation of estrogen receptor binding is part of quercetin's biologic effect. It's an antioxidant. It lowers COX-2 and LUX-5, so it modulates inflammation. It inhibits angiogenesis. It downregulates growth factors, NF-kappa-B, activates the tumor suppressor P10, normalizes P53, downregulates TNF-alpha, promotes apoptosis, downregulates PARP and BCL2, activates the caspases, so that it promotes apoptosis. That's a long list. I'm not going to read it all to you. It's in the notes. But at any rate, it's a long list. And so the benefits of quercetin are many, and certainly we don't have any papers, human studies on quercetin and estrogen receptor binding, but like other phytoestrogens, it's not the enemy. And so I don't withhold it in estrogen receptor positive patients. So that's a long answer to that question. It's very rich in purple onions and the skin of red apples in the diet, and it's actually in many, many, many food plants, so you can never be on a quercetin-free diet either. So I'm pro-quercetin, basically. I'll stop there, and if you want to comment or ask any more about phytoestrogens or quercetin, I'll take a pause. So, you know, think of quercetin as inhibiting proliferation, promoting apoptosis, and inhibiting cell invasion and metastasis. Those are its really super gifts. All right, so now we're going to do this amazing case study that was submitted by Cameron Keep. And this is an advanced stage 4 cancer patient who was diagnosed with prostate cancer in 2012. And he's currently having a recurrence and is diagnosed with bone and lymph node metastasis. He's currently 54, so he's around 50 when he was diagnosed. And he has a pretty high stress lifestyle and work and travels a lot, suffering from insomnia. He's developed an eating disorder because he's afraid of food now and he's trying to be overly strict with keto. I think we might, you know, call him anorexic the way that you describe him, Cameron. So I think certainly that's an issue. He's complaining of low energy, decreased libido, and sexual dysfunction and misses intimacy with his wife, which is a big complaint of, men who have hormonal therapy for prostate cancer. It really really impacts the quality of their life and their emotional life as well as their sexual life. So a lot of men are very have grief and feelings of loss around that. So he is on a medication called Zytiga, which I'll come to shortly, but that's a hormone blocker, and he's on Lupron as well. So we'll come to that in a moment. But let's go back to some of the data that Cameron, I didn't see any lab work, but I see your notes here, so I'm just going to go over those. His neutrophil to lymphocyte ratio is at 5.2, and so that's prognostically negative. We like to see that 4.0 or below, and we're really happy if it's 2.0 or below. So I just had a patient who is in remission right now, and I told her that her neutrophil to lymphocyte ratio is 1.67, and how and absolutely fantastic that was. And so we have something we always have in front of us, the CDC, to look at. And for those of you who have not heard or just joining the course, there's an entire clinical pearl on the neutrophil to lymphocyte ratio. So you can go ahead and listen to that, but it's a prognostic marker, and this is not good news. Also, this patient has a Gleason 6 or Gleason 9, and that's really, really bad prognostically as well. That's very advanced prostate cancer. The Gleason score measures the aggressiveness and the pervasiveness of prostate cancer. And once you get a Gleason score of 6 or above, you have a significant amount and usually an aggressive cancer. And so these two things together are prognostically not good for this patient. Also, he's osteopenic and in his lumbar spine, and he has bone mets. So I might do a urine NTX, N-telopeptide on him, see if he's having a high level of bone turnover. I might do a bone alkaline phosphatase test and a ionic calcium test to just see if his bones are just dissolving at a fast rate. And these type of patients, women also who are osteopenic and have, lumbar vertebrae that are starting to look like lace, I have them develop their core strength so they can lift off those vertebrae a bit and oppose gravity and use their muscles to hold up the spine more and take some stress off the disc and off the vertebrae there, if at all possible. And that can help a lot. And I would just make sure that he gets a DEXA scan to keep an eye on that. And because we might even want to give him lumbar support to try and prevent a fracture. You start to see these people start to bend over. You know, the way that women will get the dowager hump and their head starts to go forward, it's because their vertebrae can't hold up the weight of their head. So I wouldn't want him to have a vertebral fracture there. It's really painful. That would really damage the quality of his life. Cameron had also asked what other kinds of biomarkers I might want to look at. So in an advanced patient like this, I want to look at coagulation factors like D-dimer and fibrinogen activity, because remember, over 40% of cancer patients, particularly stage 4, will die of a thromboembolic event, not of their cancer. So, or they might have a stroke or heart attack or a pulmonary embolism. So I always want to monitor that. Unfortunately, oncologists don't. And so I'll call and call this up and say, I think we need to anticoagulate this patient. And so if they're really bad, I'll ask for Lovenox. And that is low molecular weight heparin, which also has some anti-tumor activity. But doctors don't prescribe it very much because the patient has to inject themselves. But it's so much better than the oral drugs. And now a lot of oncologists are giving like Pradaxa and these newer drugs, Eliquis, which aren't as great as the heparin, but there's more compliance with them. And of course, we have quite a lot of botanicals that lower platelet aggregation. So there's a whole clinical pearl on that also. And so, the interventions for managing hypercoagulation are in that clinical pearl, but think curcumin, omega-3 fatty acids, things like that are usually in our treatment plan. We might want to ramp those up. So I watch hypercoagulation in these patients. I also watch CRP and ESR, C-reactive protein, because you'll see patients with C-reactive proteins of like 24, you know, some of these advanced patients. And so they can be super inflamed, and then they feel lousy. They feel so lousy when they're that inflamed. And if you were to measure IL-6 and IL-1B, which we don't commonly do, you would see those elevated in these patients as well. And so then we really want to control the inflammation, if nothing else, for quality of life, because it really, the primary cause of fatigue and achiness and mood changes can be these high levels of inflammation. Then I also want to watch hemoglobin A1C, make sure that we have good glycemic control. Some of these patients are so stressed out that their cortisol is elevated and then their blood sugar goes up. And then this patient is on prednisone. So we would expect his blood sugar to be a bit higher also, which isn't good for him. I also look at IGF-1, insulin-like growth factor 1, and insulin-like growth factor receptors, because those are also prognostic. And you'll see that go up in advanced cancer patients. Intermittent fasting lowers that. Exercise lowers that. A low glycemic diet will lower that. So you get some control over a growth factor, some simple interventions. I look at selenium, zinc, copper, ceruloplasmin, red blood cell, magnesium, ferritin, iron, all of these minerals. Remember that most metastatic patients have elevated copper and ceruloplasmin because copper drives angiogenesis. So if a patient is a candidate, so this patient is not on myelosuppressive drugs, so we might be able to do oral copper chelation on this patient. So I definitely explore that. That's an option. I would also look at the red blood cell magnesium, because a lot of advanced patients are magnesium depleted, and a lot of drugs deplete magnesium. And so that can also be a quality of life issue, as well as a fatigue issue. Ferritin is an acute phase reactant, as is ceruloplasmin, also being a biomarker of inflammation. So take a look at that. I would look at the omega-3 to omega-6 ratios to see if we could improve inflammation control and improve, lower clotting and risk of a thrombus by ramping up the omegas. But remember, ramping up the omega-3s also can oppose cachexia, which most patients like this have. So, you also mentioned in here, he used to run 100 miles a month, and now he's just running 10 miles a week. But, you know, he probably has a significant loss of muscle mass from his advanced disease. So we want to always be protecting muscle mass as well. I would look at his estradiol and his DHEA if they haven't been measured. I would look at, I would expect them to be low because he's on Lupron and Zytiga. But, you know, take a look. I also would look at LDH because that can help guide us in mitochondrial function. And GGPT I look at for toxic burden. And so those are the things I would think about ordering on him to see if there were any other handholds that we might have to optimize his physiology. Of course, vitamin D. I don't think I mentioned that. We'd want to optimize his vitamin D as well. So that's what I would look at. And so he's currently on Lupron, which is a gonadotropin antagonist. And I would, oh, he's also on prednisone and Zytiga. So Zytiga is a prodrug that turns into abiraterone. It's an androgen inhibitor, basically. It's always given with prednisone. And it's really hepatotoxic, so I would track his liver function test. And one of the main adverse effects is hypertension. So it's another reason to optimize magnesium. as well. And with that goes headaches in some of these patients. So that's kind of the overview of the patient. So Cameron asks, because his priorities are quality of life, peace, relaxation. Oh, no, that's my priorities for him. Hold on. Cameron asks, I'd appreciate your thoughts and suggestions on a health plan, on the health plan that I've devised. So I'll give you feedback on that. We'll go through that in a moment. But my priorities for a patient like this would be quality of life, you know, inner peace, more relaxation, teach him how to feel more intimate with his wife, even though they can't have intercourse successfully, really be on top of his nutrient density. And then I would add a cytotoxic and adaptogenic support to your current treatment plan. So we're going to go through that line by line. And then you also mentioned that he has a history of uranium and radioisotope exposure in his 20s. And does that change anything I would do? So this man is 54 and he was exposed in his 20s. So the insult and the damage occurred at the time of exposure. And so there's not much we can really do about it right now. I mean, you could look at the amount of oxidative stress in his system, but it would be high given what he's going through. But the damage has been done from that exposure. So there's nothing we can really do to make that not evident or have happened. So let me go through your treatment plan with my comments and then what I would add. And then we can all talk about it. So I'm going to read Cameron's plan and then make my comments. So she has him on Osteoband, which is for bone support. Also has genistein in it. So I like that. We need bone support in a patient who's osteopenic and has bone mets. And, oh, he's also on denosumab, I believe, to protect his bones. So I like that. Denosumab binds to the RANK ligand, and so does curcumin. So that curcumin, we might want to up the dose of curcumin in a patient like this. Vitamin D, she has him on oral vitamin D, but his vitamin D should be optimized to 75 nanograms per milliliter. So I just measure his vitamin D to make sure that you're getting up to that range. These patients utilize vitamin D at a very high rate. She has them on Metabolic Synergy, 3 tabs BID. This is one of my favorite multivitamins. It's iron-free and copper-free. And it's a broad-spectrum, high-potency multivitamin. She's on Omegavail 2. Omegavail 2 tabs a day. I would make sure you're giving him 6 grams of omegas a day. I like the Omegavail TG1000 because it's a gram per cap, and so it's just less caps, or the Omegavail liquid that Designs for Health has, 2 tablespoons, gets you up to 6 grams. It tastes pretty good. So I'd shoot for that in a day. We mentioned adding magnesium. I'd give them 300 milligrams BID as glycinate, and then I'd add adaptogens for a patient like this, something like maybe Designs for Health Adrenodone or Natura Power Adapt. These are basically adaptogenic herbs promoting stress resilience. I don't see probiotics in your plan. I always put probiotics in every plan. I particularly like Claire's Therabiotic Complete, and earlier in this lecture, we mentioned the Target GBX by Claire as well for more mood-related things that we can address with probiotics and protecting the brain. A patient like this definitely has a breached blood-brain barrier, and if you haven't taken a history of his cognitive function, then I'd inquire, see if you want to add melatonin to his protocol, for example. And then I want to make sure a patient like this has prebiotics, so that could be in his diet already, but Designs for Health Paleo Fiber is a brilliant, brilliant formula that is designed to supply a broad spectrum of prebiotic fibers so that the probiotics can colonize and flourish. Or you could give something like Saccharomyces boulardii, made by a number of companies, as a prebiotic. But those things, I think, should be put into the plan. Melatonin, 20 milligrams, is already in the plan. Karen's also giving modified citrus pectin, which I would definitely include. Remember, you have to take that away from food and supplements because it binds to nutrients. Otherwise, she also has them on the mycophyto complex powder, which is a mushroom complex that I love. This is a super high quality product. Econugenics is the retail line, and Clinical Synergy is the professional line of products made by Dr. Isaac Elias, all of which are super high quality. The modified citrus pectin and the mycophyto are his. I love those. I include those in most of my advanced cancer patients. And then what I would do is what this protocol is missing is something really cytotoxic. So we need to do something because this guy's just really on hormonal therapy. So remember, we can impact signaling and the behavior of tumor cells in a lot of other ways. So this is a protocol that I use. So Natura Health Products has a product called Phytocyto, and it is a combination of a number of herbs that are mildly toxic. And so I give it 1 week on, 1 week off. And I alternate it, 60 drops of Phytocyto 3 times a day for 1 week. And then the alternate week, I use Allergy Research Group Super Artemisinin, 2 caps, 3 times a day. And I alternate those. And one of the reasons I alternate them is that tumor cells can become adapted to them. So if you pulse it, you get more therapeutic effect. Then I would put 4 grams of curcumin a day, 2 caps. Actually, I put 2 caps 3 times a day, 6 grams if you could tolerate it. And then Allergy Research makes a product called Vascustatin, which is Convolvulus arvensis, and it's a super anti-angiogenic botanical, 2 caps twice a day. There's another product that's made from that same herb called C-statin. It's the same thing, made by another company. I think Aidens makes it. And then Cheese Enterprise is a Chinese herbal company that makes a product called AngioStop, and it's made from sea cucumber extract. And that's really powerful, anti-angiogenic, 2 caps a day. Now, I just have to say, this starts to get super expensive. So you have to see what somebody can do. And you might only be able to pick one or two of these things. But if I had a patient who could afford to do this, this is what I have them do. And then to that, I add some custom botanicals, which we'll get to in a moment. So these are cytotoxic, anti-angiogenic things that could be added in aggressive doses if the patient can afford it. Functional foods, she's got him on a shake with pea protein. Make sure there's 30 grams of protein per shake. Person this age might need some digestive enzymes with that. She's got the green powder. I would like to see the paleo fiber added to promote a more healthy microbiome, and also carnitine, because we know this guy is sarcopenic and maybe even a little cachectic. And you could add the mycophyto as a powder to the shake so he didn't have one more pill to swallow. And some of these patients, I'll just have them throw some of their capsules in the shake that don't have taste, like magnesium and vitamin D and things like that, so they just have less mountain of pills to take. So I can see that he's lost 20 pounds, she says. And you're dealing with his eating disorder and his ideas about food. I don't think he should be on a strict ketogenic diet. I think he should do intermittent fasting and then just eat more food and more shakes during the day. That would still be a low carbohydrate diet, but he could get a lot of the effects of ketogenic diet out of just intermittent fasting. So pick 8 hours of the day where you eat and then fast the other 16. You can get a similar effect and then not have to be so strict with your food. So I can see that you're she's trying to work with him with his food and his stress and guided imagery. And she's introduced suggestions to spend more time outside and be in nature and to do deep breathing and centering and relaxation. And so that's all, you know, this is a treatment plan for the whole person. It's really beautiful. So here's some other things that we could do. If you had access to someone who could do high dose IV vitamin C, that would be valuable as a cytotoxic therapy. I recommend that highly in patients like this. And then I also have my patients do intravenous mistletoe or subcutaneous mistletoe as an immunotherapy. So just think about all the things we just talked about. Cytotoxic therapies, immunotherapies, adaptogenic herbs. So these are things these patients desperately need. The oncologist is just doing hormonal therapy on this patient and protecting the skeleton. So we could do so much more. Also, think about oral copper chelation. We mentioned that. If this patient has high copper and high ceruloplasmin, we could chelate them with tetrathiomolybdate. And then you could also consider metformin. Metformin is used, there's a lot of studies on metformin in breast cancer and metformin in prostate cancer, not because of hemoglobin A1C and insulin sensitivity, but because it impacts DNA methylation. So that's why we use off-label in patients like this. So that's another idea. Then in this treatment plan, I have put a custom botanical formula that I would mix in my clinic. That's cytotoxic for more tumor control. And in that formula, I put Scutellaria bicolensis, Salvia miltiariza, Rhabdozia, Polygonatum. I wrote this all down for you guys. I'm just going to tell you as a big picture. The green tea, Oldenlandia, milk thistle, and feverfew, those are all the anti-inflammatory cytotoxic botanicals. And then into that formula, I would add adaptogens, which you could take with those. Ashwagandha, rhodiola, red ginseng, astragalus for more immune support as well. And then I add some digestive herbs like chenpea, tangerine peel, or ginger root. And then all traditional Chinese formulas add a little bit of licorice root as a harmonizing herb. So that's like something I would compound for this patient and have him take 2 teaspoons a day. But if you didn't have access to being able to compound a formula like that, you could do something like get some of the classic Chinese herb formulas, like minor buplerum is one formula, astragalus and ganoderma is another formula, and pinelia and magnolia is another formula that would have some immune modulating anti-tumor effects. Not as strong as what I put together, but you could do 2 grams each of those 3 formulas a day mixed together, and then add some Danshan, Salvia miltiariza, and some Hongqian, the Scutellaria bicolensis, and a little red ginseng. And you could sort of cobble that together if you can't compound herbs, because you could order these formulas and single herbs in powder form, for example. So you can do that for your patient. And you could think about, as I mentioned earlier, if you just want to pick an adaptogenic formula, so I like the Adrenatone by Designs for Health and the Power Adapt by Natura, which are basically rhodiola, ashwagandha, Siberian ginseng. They're that type of a formula. So that is my treatment plan for this patient. It is 6:30 right now, and so I'm going to stop talking, and we can take 10, 15 minutes to discuss this. You guys can ask questions. And so you can unmute yourself and ask any questions that you want about this treatment plan. But it is uploaded to the site if you didn't have an opportunity to read through it as we were going through it on the call.
Dr. Choco?
Yes.
Yes, hi, this is Cameron. This
is
my case. Yes. Thank you so much. This is so helpful. I appreciate it. I'll add one little thing that he told me the other day, and then I have a question about the cytotoxic piece. Mm-hmm. He did tell me that they're probably going to be adding the LU-177 radionuclide to him.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that would impact with, like, the copper, if he does have higher copper chelation.
Yeah, I mean, we'd have to see what they're actually going to do, you know. We'll have to see what they're actually going to do and how they're going to do it, you know. But the bottom line is this patient is out of control, you know. His cancer is out of control. And, you know, my focus on a patient like this would be to give him as much health span and lifespan and quality of life as possible. And, you know, it's a worthy goal to stop progression. Will we see a big reduction in tumor burden in a patient like this? Maybe not. He's pretty treatment resistant.
Yeah.
You know,
well, this
so,
will be,
you know,
Okay. My question was, because I hadn't included any cytotoxic herbs. I know you mentioned that you're going to be doing an advanced module on that, because they're just, that's not something I've worked with in the past.
Right, right.
So with the phytocyto and those two that you mentioned, how long would you do those, and would you need to monitor anything with those?
No. I mean, you know, it's not like doing chemotherapy. Some patients
right.
get nauseous, so make sure they have fluid in their stomach. And with the artemisinin, if you have something with a little bit of iron in it, it makes it more active, because the artemisinin binds to iron. And the reason artemisinin works is that artemisinin binds to iron, and tumor cells sequester iron. So it creates a little oxidative stress bomb inside the tumor cell. And that's how a lot of chemotherapy agents work. Like, that's how the platinum drugs work. So it creates that kind of oxidative stress. But then again, so does IV vitamin C. But not everybody can afford IV vitamin C or has access to it. So this is a way to accomplish something like that. So no, I don't, patients don't typically complain of a toxicity. They sometimes complain of nausea or GI stuff on the phytocyto, but I've never had anybody complain of anything on the artemisinin.
Okay. And you can do those every other week for how long would you go, and would you do any other seasonal breaks, or would you just...
I don't. I mean, you know, you can do it for 6 months and see where you're at, you know. You can do
okay.
You know, I reevaluate my treatment plans about every 3 months.
Yeah. Okay. All right. That helps a lot. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Anybody else want to ask about this? So we can follow up with this patient also. You know, that's a really interesting thing to do, is, you know, go ahead and do some interventions, Cameron, and then come back to us and tell us what's happening with this patient. And we might be able to follow him and, you know, continue to learn how to manage a case like this as well. Did anybody else want to comment on anything or ask any questions? So I just want to say that this is an example of a type of treatment plan that I will do with patients that have significant disease burden. And so it's a good model. And then there are some other case studies in the course, some cases that are in the course itself in the later modules. And there are also cases posted in the library, the resource library of the course, that we've discussed in other calls. So there's some really interesting cases there of different types of cancer. And so I'll also say, anyone in the course who's presented a case previously and would like to follow the patient and give us an update and resubmit that patient, and we can look at what's happening in them, I think that's a great thing to do over time. All right, everyone, so thank you so much. Remember to let us know what you want to hear in Clinical Pearls, what you want added to the course, your questions. There are reference articles for many of the things I spoke about today. And so I will see you next month. Thank you so much for your participation. Remember, I need about 2 weeks prep time if you submit a case or questions, and our next call is just in 3 weeks, so think about what you would like to ask or submit so that it can be included. We did have a case submitted late that I didn't get to tonight, so we'll get to it next month. And so thank you, everyone, and have a great summer, and I'll see you all here in a month. Good night.